Welcome everybody to a double feature. Not Tazria Metzora, just Tazria, but Parshas HaChodesh. We started a few weeks ago, we ushered in the four special additional readings of this time of the year, weeks leading up to Pesach. The first, so there's an extra Torah portion that is added on to the regular weekly portion. The weekly portion this week is just one Tazria, normally combined with the next one, Netzora. But this year being a leap year, there's extra weeks, and therefore many of the double portions are separated. But the extra reading is known as Parshas HaChodesh, the section dealing with the making of the months. And that is actually a reading from the book of Shemos, of Exodus, beginning with chapter 12. It falls in the Parsha of Bo. And at the beginning of the chapter 12, Hashem speaks to Moshe and gives him what, in essence, is the very first mitzvah. Prior to this, the only mitzvahs that are mentioned in the Torah are mitzvahs given to individuals, such as Abraham, even before that, Adam and Chava, the mitzvah of procreating, Abraham, the mitzvah of circumcision, Yaakov, the prohibition against eating the sciatic nerve. But those are not, you wouldn't necessarily call them mitzvahs to the Jewish people, because there was no Jewish people yet. After the Jewish people have been formed through the exodus from Egypt, leading up to the Exodus, Hashem now approaches Moshe and says, I'm about to give you the first mitzvahs, the first instructions. And the very, very first mitzvah that Hashem gives Moshe to instruct to the Jewish people is the mitzvah of making a calendar and establishing chodoshim, months, based on a lunar a revolution. And that is the very first mitzvah of the Torah. Interesting how many implications of that the basis of Judaism is as a system of time and of measuring time, and of course all of our holidays and Shabbos and every, well, not Shabbos. Shabbos runs on a solar system, but the holidays, which are based on certain dates in a month, all revolve around the lunar calendar. And so that is really being introduced as the very first mitzvah. The next mitzvah, or series of mitzvahs, revolves around the ritual commandment that was required of the Jews before they could leave Egypt, and that was the rite of the Paschal Lamb, or as we say in the Hebrew, Korban Pesach, the sacrifice of the Passover. And so most of the reading that is added on, the second part, the second Torah, deals with the detailed laws concerning the Paschal Lamb. And indeed, this was a ceremony, a rite that took place for centuries, beginning from the sojourn in the desert all the way up until the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 of the Common Era. Every year, the Jewish people, every household, would personally partake of a lamb and follow all of these instructions. The matzah, the maror, was originally just a part of that ceremony of the lamb. We don't have the lamb, and therefore we just still continue to do the matzah and the maror. But the real service is including the lamb, and God willing, will be restored with the advent of the Messianic Age and the rebuilding of the Temple. And I didn't tell you what Tazria is about. Well, let's talk about that for a moment. Tazria is one of two Parshios which introduces a very, very strange topic. It should be even the most strange to Dr. Schultz, because it talks about disease. And Dr. Schultz is a physician that specializes in disease. But it would be very, very strange, because it is a disease which totally defies the natural realm. I'm referring to the condition called tzara'as. Many scholars have attempted to align the the symptoms described in the Torah with various physiological conditions known in the medical science field. However, with careful study of the rabbinic sources revolving around this mitzvah, one is comes to the realization that one cannot subsume all of the laws of tzara'as into the realm of science. Just to mention a few, in Tazria, after the first opening sections, which deals with childbirth and circumcision, but it goes into the tzara'as that occurs on a person's body and various spots of a white color and different formations and so forth, coloring of discoloration of the hair, and there's a lot of detailed description of the manifestation of tzara'as. But after that, it goes into, on page 616, 617, it goes into tzara'as which afflicts garments, or even spools of thread, furniture. And then in the next parsha, Metzora, which is really the second half of Tazria, there is the realm of tzara'as of houses. You know, so you can say, well, that's just mold and mildew. But again, with careful study, there are certain laws governing tzara'as which clearly show that we do not take tzara'as to be a medical condition. A person is not sent to a doctor; a person is sent to a kohen, and the kohen has to make certain judgments. B, if you read the Mishnah, the oral law, it says that, for an example, if a person was getting married and he found the tzara'as on him, and it was during the 7 days of celebration, the Sheva Brachas, he would be allowed to defer going to the Kohen for a judgment until after the 7 days. I mean, if a person, God forbid, comes down with a infectious disease that may be, life-threatening. It doesn't matter what a person is involved in, whether he's involved in personal simcha or work or what have you. And there are other such indications. I'm not going to go into that right now, but suffice it to say, and our Rebbe, Rav Yerucham Lavavitz, quotes at the very beginning of his treatment of the subject, the sources that go to great lengths to prove that there is nothing natural at all about tzara'as. Citing Ramban, citing Sepharno, and it's empirical evidence from a full understanding of the topic. So what we have here in Tazria is a subject of supernatural afflictions of the body or of possessions. Our oral tradition tells us that it is a sign from God that the person needs to improve some area in his character. Most often, lashon hara, evil talk about others in a derogatory way, in a habitual proportion, or haughtiness, gasus haruach, arrogance, kind of a very, very detrimental character trait. And when the person takes note of that and improves his ways, then that is when he can expect that the tzara'as will fade. And they say that this was the fact that we had this, the existence of these signs, of these divine signs, was a mark of great distinction, that we were so close to God, so to speak, as to have this signal from Him. Mr. Plony, you need to stop speaking lashon hara. Okay, God, I got the message. and it would, you know, then it would go away. It shows that God is actually holding us in a very high standard, and doesn't tolerate, and doesn't just let us continuing in our habitual ways, and that's why it is Tzaras only existed in a time when the Jewish people were on overall in a very high spiritual level. We don't have Tzaras anymore today, just like we don't have the temple, we don't have the sacrifices. I'm saying even though Tzaras is something which indicates a deficiency, a spiritual deficiency, only a spiritually healthy people would even have that kind of a system. Just like we talked a few weeks ago that, or I think in dealing with the Mishkan, Rav Yerucham made the point that we can't expect to have the sacrifices unless we're on the level where we desire so strongly that God's presence be among us. And the same thing is true with Tzaras. But it is within the realm of possibility. It is something that God instilled into the world, into the fabric of creation, that people can receive, can be visited with these physical symptoms in response to a spiritual deficiency. What Rav Yerucham does here is he makes an amazing connection, I believe, between the Parsha of Tazria and the Parsha of Bo and the Exodus. And I don't know if he was doing it deliberately, because usually Tazria does not occur until after Pesach. And so it's not a typical shidduch to have Tazria with Parsha HaChodesh. But it was just inescapable to me that he made the connection. So I'd like to start off by sharing some words on the secondary reading, the reading of HaChodesh from Shemos chapter 12, or maybe it's chapter 13, and then tie it back to Tazria. There's a famous chapter 13, actually. What I'm referring to, actually, is a famous... What does famous mean? I heard of it. a well-known commentary of Nachmanides on the Chumash. And it's actually very, very fundamental, where he describes the purpose of creation and what we're trying to accomplish through the commandments and the centrality of the Exodus of Egypt. So he speaks about the concept of miracles. And here's the translation, Rabbi Chevel's translation of Nachmanides. Through the great open miracles, one comes to admit the hidden miracles, which constitute the foundation of the whole Torah. For no one can have a part in the Torah of Moses, our teacher, unless he believes that all our words and our events, as dictated in the Torah, are miraculous in scope, there being no natural or customary way of the world in them, whether affecting the public or the individual. Let me try to restate that. Working backwards. We cannot truly believe in the Torah and live by the Torah without a clear understanding and acceptance of the fact that everything that happens in the world is under the providence and the direction of the hand of God. Whether it be a miracle or whether it be what we call nature. We've had many sessions together. Last year, Rav Dessler spoke about this a lot. Teva versus Nace, nature, quote, versus miracle. And there is a distinction, there are two different terms, but the proper understanding is that even what we call nature is really a miracle. It is, when it rains, that's the hand of God. When the grass grows, that's the hand of God. That's the will of God. it's not just happening because that's what plants. Yes. It's not just doesn't just happen because that's what plants do. It's because God wills that the plants do them. And we don't just live because we were born. It's because God has a will that Reuven be alive at this time, and that Reuven has a purpose in his life, and Shimon and Levi, and everything that occurs to Reuven and Shimon and Levi is in direct connection with the way that God is directing that person's affairs, together with his own free choice, of course. How do we come to learn that? Where do we get that? How do we learn that lesson? I mean, if all my teachers in grade school taught me that there's a system of nature, that there's processes called photosynthesis, and that the sun rises because the earth spins on its axis, and that the moon is a crescent because it's revolving around the sun, and the sun is hitting it around the earth, and the sun is hitting it at a certain angle, and never met it mentioned a word about God. How then am I supposed to so easily accept that everything that's happening is God's hand? And the Ramban responds by saying that is one of the most important lessons that we learn from the story of the Exodus. And his words again, through the great open miracles, one comes to admit the hidden miracles. I've heard this line before. Remember, it's famous. But I'll tell you honestly, until I read Rav Yerucham Lubavitch's explanation, I didn't really understand it. See, I didn't understand, and it was simply just a lack on my part. I didn't understand, just because there are miracles sometimes, why does that mean that the rest of the time it's not just nature? I didn't make the logical connection. You know, the 10 plagues. Okay? So God turned the Nile River into blood. Why does that mean that plant growth and that bodily functions are therefore the hand of God? What does one have to do with the other? But he explains it, and it's really quite simple. It's quite simple. Everything that I believe to be true about nature is only true as long as it keeps working that way. Right? If there's a law of gravity, then the law of gravity is a law. And it is you might as well just chalk it up to, independent power until it stops. Photosynthesis is just a fact of life until the plants stop growing. Dark and light, night and day, is just a constant revolution of the sun and the moon and the planets until the sun doesn't set. Water is H2O and is liquid at this temperature and becomes a gas at that temperature and becomes frozen at that temperature until it doesn't. Until water turns to blood. Or until water freezes without cold. All of the miracles, what they did was they put a halt into the systems of nature. When a person who could be the greatest scientist in the world, he could have an explanation for all of these phenomena, but as soon as everything that says in the books stop working that way, he has to, if he is an honest person, he has to stop and say, I really don't understand this. And not only I don't understand it, I don't know what's causing it now. There must be somebody who's controlling it. Now, as easy as I'm making it sound, it's easier said than done. Because the fact is, even when unusual, bordering on supernatural occurrences occur, many scientists will still try to explain it scientifically, and they will bend over backwards until they can find a satisfactory explanation that fits in with their scheme. But it comes a point, maybe we haven't witnessed as many of those miracles as they did back then, but there comes a point where you just have to throw up your hands and say, God is running the world. That's what the Ramban means. That God performed miracles at rare occasions throughout history just so that we would realize that there's no such thing as nature. It's really in His hand. It works because He wants it to work, when He wants it to work, and when He doesn't want it to work, it stops. And that is supposed to be what we take out of this. And that's the foundation, he says, of Judaism. If one doesn't accept that, if one doesn't accept that there is consequence, that there's reward, that things are happening for a reason, that God controls, that God can change it, whether it be health, whether it be illness, God forbid, whether it be economic facts of nature, that's also not nature. We have to have a massive readjustment of our way of thinking, and we have to accept that everything is in the hands of God. Until we do that, we can't really buy into the Torah. That's what the Ramban says. So that's one of the main themes and messages and lessons of the story of the Exodus. And it's very appropriate that the Jewish people who were just being formed had to learn that lesson at that time. As the Ramban says, it's a fundamental principle of the Torah. And this way we can console ourselves that even though we're not privy to seeing these open miracles all the time, but maybe we don't need them. As long as we have them in our Torah, as long as we continue to pass them down, as long as we continue on an annual basis, even on a daily basis, to remember the Exodus from Egypt, and on Pesach to dwell on it and to tell the stories in great detail and very vivid description to our children, then we will remember this lesson and we'll be able to look at the world in the proper way that we should. Now, bringing that back to Tazria, the advent of Tzaras is really the same thing, because Tzaras is something where if you study it, you understand properly how it comes about, you have to admit is not part of nature. And it forces us to confront the reality that it is a direct manifestation of the will of God. And it was sent as a divine sign to the individual as a reminder that he should consider his ways and to repair them. In the same vein, Rabbi Yerucham says, just like we say that the miracles of the Exodus are there to show us how everything that occurs in the world is really the hand of God, so too, he says, the concept of Tzaras is also there to teach us that everything happens in our own personal lives, particularly in the way that our bodies function, in the way that our personal situation is also not just haphazard. That's also the hand of God. And so that just as we've just explained, we don't have the miracles, but we don't need them because we have the story of the miracles and the messages that nature is the hand of God. We may not have Tzaras, but the lesson of Tzaras is still there. When our bodies will function, it's because that's the will of God. When we have an ache or a pain, that's the will of God. God's talking to us. What is He saying? That's a different question. It may be hard to answer, but He's definitely talking. He's definitely snapping His fingers and say, "Hi, I'm here. I want to be part of your life. Make me part of yours." And so... Once we have Tzaras, it has to be that way. We have to admit that God is involved in our lives, personally, intimately, in every limb. And that should be something which changes our perspective. And we have to take the messages. We have to respond. We have to feel moved and energized and alive and awake by the fact that God woke me up this morning and says, "Hey, Reuven, Shimon, I want you to get up this morning. I want you to welcome me into your life. I want you to grow. I want you to energize yourselves with my reality. I want you to make something of yourselves. I want you to connect with me. I want you to learn. I want you to do. I want you to embrace the wonderful attributes. I want you to emulate me. I want you to become godlike. I want you to share. I want you to have chesed and gevura, strength and emes, truth. I want you to pursue it." This is what we should think of when we wake up, because that's what God is telling us. Otherwise, He wouldn't have woken us up. Sounds beautiful. How come it is that it's so easy to lose that? It's so easy to go through life without that level of awareness. So here Rav Yerucham shares with us a secret. Man has great potential. Man was created in God's image. But we also have a tremendous handicap. He cites for us almost a humorous verse from Proverbs. This is found in Mishle chapter 26, verse 3. Shot lasus. The whip works for the horse. I think it's actually not a whip. I think it might be like a paddle. The whip or the paddle for the horse. Meseg lachamor. The bridle. What's the thing? The bit for the donkey. The shevet legab kesalim, but the staff for the fools. What does that all mean? The way to get a horse to go where you want it to go. I'm not a cowboy, but apparently, if you train the horse once, by hitting it a couple of times with the paddle, all you have to do is lift up the paddle. And the horse starts moving. He can go for hours and hours. Wow, that's great. You know, what great reaction. Very little motivation was needed to get the horse to do his job. Lift up the paddle. The donkey is a little more stubborn. The donkey, you've got to keep the bit on its mouth, and you got to hold on to the reins. You got to keep it on track so it shouldn't stop or shouldn't veer off the side of the road. You need a little bit more to control the donkey. But when it comes to the Gav Kesalim, when it comes to the fools, who are the fools? We. Then you need a club. You know, we're so great. We're so intelligent. We're so creative. We're so strong. We're so multifaceted. And yet, it takes a lot more than lifting up a paddle or a bridle to keep us on the right path. And that's our condition. That's how we were created. That's how we've morphed into through the various stages of human development from Adam and Eve down to Noah, down to Abraham, down to the generations, and so on, etc. And there's many factors going into it. In the end of the result, we come out that we're stubborn, we're slow, we're independent-minded, right? We have a mind of our own, and it takes a lot to motivate us and to keep us on the right path. But if we know that, and we also know, we learn the lesson of the tzaras, and we learn the lesson of the miracles. And we come to the realization that we have these multimedia sound and light show around us at all times. We're constantly being bombarded with the hand of God in the outside world, within ourselves internally, physically, emotionally, mentally we're constantly bombarded, then we can find those tools of motivation around us all the time. And the more we make students of ourselves, the more we pick up on these signs and on these reminders, the less God will have to resort to the shevet l'kasilim, to the club for the fools, God forbid. Because one way or the other, God wants us to succeed. And if that's what it takes to motivate us, He'll do it. Not because He's mad at us, not because He has anything against us, on the contrary, because He wants us to succeed, and we sometimes need a real shot in the arm. But it's up to us. The motivation of having a world where we see it as the hand of God, so intimately involved in our lives as a nation and as individuals. If one really, you know, tells the story of the Exodus on a daily basis, and one focuses on the reality of the connection between God and our physical well-being, one really could have all the motivation he or she needs to always be there, or take reminders here and there and jump right back on the wagon. So this Ramban says is essential for the life of Torah. One cannot have a part in the Torah of Moses unless he believes that all our words are events miraculous in scope, being no natural or customary way of the world. It's when we fall into the sleep of thinking everything's just humdrum, everything just goes on in the world because that's the way it goes, because it did it yesterday, that's why it's going to do it today. When we take God out of the picture, then our world becomes flat, and our world becomes unexciting and unenergized. But when we remember that what's going on around us is 24/7, the hand of God pushing us and cajoling us and caressing us, we have all the motivation that we need, and God willing, we don't have to wait. We can learn a little bit from the horse and get up and move and react proactively as well to get to where we have to go.
Rabbi, when calamities such as the tsunami in Asia occur, people inevitably say, why did God permit this to happen?
Mm-hmm.
200,000 people died suddenly. And one of the answers that one hears is that, well, God created nature, and this is a force of nature, and God chose not to intervene in this event. Had he intervened, it wouldn't have happened, but he permitted it to happen. So there's kind of a yin-yang here. He created nature and keeps nature operative constantly. How much does he control each and every event?
The ultimate lesson of the plagues and of the miracles is that it's more than just God didn't intervene. God didn't intervene because He willed this to happen. It's as if, what difference does it make if He caused it to happen or if He didn't intervene? What difference? That's semantics. The fact is, God willed that it happen. So I remember the date. What was the date?
Of
the tsunami occurrence?
December 26th.
All right, so on December 26th, at whatever time it was, a Jew who's learning the Torah correctly should have been listening and hearing that God made an announcement over the loudspeaker. People of the world, I need you to realize that you're sleeping. I need you to realize that you are completely oblivious to the reality that I run the world. I am trying to get you to take heed and take notice of that. And if we do any less than that, less cognizance than that, and I didn't even get into specifics, because that's really an area that we have a hard time with. I think it would take somebody very, very scholarly and saintly, and maybe bordering on prophecy, to be able to exactly pinpoint what is the lesson from that. But at the very least, to say God is talking to us on December 26th, and we've got to change. We've got to be different today than we were yesterday. And not to do that is to deny the Torah. And as the Rambam Maimonides says, a person who says that's nature and turns around on the other side of the pillow, goes back to sleep, is being inhumanely cruel and is the cause for such events to happen again.
So the explanation that it's an act of nature in which God just not to intervene is totally invalid.
It doesn't make it's not saying anything. In other words, it's avoiding the point. It's just getting involved in semantics. That's not the question. The question is, what is the message? Is God communicating to us or not? And if there's no attempt to acknowledge that God is communicating with us, then we've totally missed the point. That's the lesson from this parsha.
If I can extend it for one more question.
Sure. So when, I hope I'm clear about that. I mean.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
But to take it one step further, when God communicates to us in these ways, large and small.
Yes.
Good and bad.
Yes.
The message is always the same. Draw closer to me.
Correct. You can't fail with that message. Are there more specific messages? There may be. Do we have access to knowing them? Possibly. Certainly a good avenue, if you wanted to pursue it, is to seek out someone of great, as I say, great Torah wisdom, experience, you know, righteousness, and you'll be in a better place than trying to figure it out on your own. Or to ask the newscaster, there may be answers. But either way, certainly draw closer is definitely a good response and a correct response.
It's the soul response, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's the soul response. Okay, Eshkayach.